Cameron of Cosmos, who was, you know, whose reputation, you see you laugh, whose reputation was really taken apart by the anti-democratic forces after he lost power, so that you would forget that actually he was a brilliant leader in spite of some of his flaws as opposed to his later lunacy. A lot of us go crazy at the end, you know. But he wasn't crazy when he was in power and in the lead up to power. And they didn't like him largely because of what he stood for, which was an egalitarian society and public education. The family, you know, the family compact of Central Canada was called the Family Company Compact here, the Hudson's Bay Company. And they're the people who really went at his reputation. Anyway, he used to talk about the great principle of public education. So I only quote you all those things because I think it's just important to keep reminding ourselves of the length of the experience, of the foundations of Canadian democracy, that it was highly intellectual, highly conscious, highly intentional. It was not accidental. It was not something borrowed from elsewhere. It was something made up here from bits and pieces we found around the world, not in Britain and not in France and not in the United States, except for a little bit from New York State for our education system, but most of it came from places like Switzerland and Prussia and so on. So this long experience that led to public education being central to the foundation of Canadian democracy. I spoke a moment ago about stability and then how stability gives us flexibility, the flexibility to adjust in order to succeed better and better. The danger is that as you succeed better and better, as you become more and more comfortable, you tend to forget that all of this is built upon a foundation. You're driving, I don't know, I'll change the image, you're driving this car that gets fancier and fancier down a road, and you really start to forget that you're going over Muskeg and, you know, bridges, and that all this stuff has to be looked after, because if you let the road go, you can have the fanciest car you want, it's just going to come to a halt in the mud. And you cannot forget the foundation, because if you do, you will undermine the stability. And I feel that, and I think many other people, that over the last 10 to 15 years, there has been a growing, orchestrated chorus, a bad Greek chorus, of a phony tragedy, claiming that there is a failure and that the failure is public education. There's a failure of quality, there's a failure of cost, there's a failure of too many taxes, all relating to public education. And that they have brilliant new solutions, which are essentially an increase in private education, a stripping down of services offered in schools, and of course people paying for an increasing number of what I received as normal and what they are now describing as extras. The reality is, there is no failure. The public education system in this country is not a failure. It's a success story. And, you know, this morning, Jill and I were at Gladstone Secondary, and we spent the whole morning there. We were in an assembly with, 700 kids, and then we were in a room with 20 kids. And we spent, about 2.5, 3 hours chatting with them. I mean, this is very impressive. I mean, a lot of people used to think of that area as being a troubled area. The school is being troubled. And they're troubled by the fact that people might think that. And in fact, I made a suggestion to them, which I hope you don't mind, which is they were worrying about their public image. And I said that I thought what they should do was call you up and ask, politely demand, whatever you like, that since the Governor General and I were being received by the editorial board, that perhaps you could receive them at another time. And that they would love to... And I say this not because I think that the paper is doing a bad job talking about the city, but because I think that newspapers are really the place where the first tier debate takes place. And I think if kids can come and talk about, without teachers, without parents, just the kids, come and talk with you about how they imagine their school, their education, immigration, multiculturalism, their area, I think you'd find it fascinating. I think, and I said maybe you can get some summer jobs. I mean, I didn't promise I could. But you know, it's an in, sort of thing. I think we have to start hearing those voices because they have really original things to say, and they're different from what the other generations are saying. It's not because youth's always smarter, but I think that their experiences are remarkably different. And they're adjusting, interestingly enough, to the direction in which the society is going, in some ways better than the parents' generations are. So, first thing. The second thing is that what's being offered are not new solutions. They're actually rather old-fashioned solutions. They're ideological solutions, which are disguised as managerial methodology, a way to be more efficient in the delivery of services, in other boring phrases like that. Whereas, in fact, what it's really about is an ideological view imported as to how public education might be done. And I think that that is the reason we don't see it is perhaps an inadvertent, one of those inadvertent outcomes of success, a misunderstanding of success. You know, other countries made choices, different kinds of choices. Our neighbor chose to go increasingly towards what they would call an elite education, which is increasingly divided from the public school system, which makes them more and more like the old Britain, which is to say a class-based society. That's fine. If that's the way they want to go, it's their decision. But it's a very different decision, and frankly, I think a very inappropriate decision approach for a country like Canada to take. It would create enormous problems in Canada. I think the other problem that comes is that as you become more successful, those who are most successful, if you're not careful, if we don't pay attention, I say we because, you know, I'm relatively successful. So I have to wake up in the morning and say to myself that just because you're more successful doesn't mean that you can slip into benefiting in what I would call the traditional manner. You know, suddenly you go from, you know, my great-grandfather was, you know, a literate mason, and suddenly here you are, you know, world, you know, renowned author called excellency, and you think to yourself, well, you know, should be treated differently or something. Well, no, you shouldn't be, apart from that little moment when I walk in. And that's not for me. That's for the institution. So it's that reminding yourself that if you belong to the upper middle classes and you start to act as if you should be treated in some traditional manner that social elites are treated, private schools, well, that's a perfectly normal thing for richer people to have, then you're on your way towards abandoning the egalitarian middle class society which has been so successful in Canada. And that is a great danger to this country. The other thing which I think has happened is that, and I'm not saying everybody's like that, I'm just saying it's a danger. We have to really watch that. The other thing is the growth of the consultancy industry. Now, there are various explanations for that, and I don't have time for how that happened, but it's part of the rise of utilitarian rationality, and which isn't rational at all, but anyway. But there's no question that over the last 20 years, we've seen a cutting down on governments thinking for themselves in an independent manner, and an increasing reliance on the consultancy industry. The idea being that these are outside independent voices, and that money is being saved because there are fewer civil servants doing this work. Well, first of all, consultants are not an independent source of ideas. You know, don't take it personally, those of you who are here, if you're consultants. It's essentially a movement in North America that comes out of a couple of cities and a couple of schools, not in Canada. And it's based around certain ideas of management theory, which are underneath that ideological. It's basically in the service of private industry, which is fine, and so it should be. And it's basically the business of trying to save money for private industry. So when you bring that into the public sector, inadvertently, you're undermining yourself. When deputy ministers feel the only place they can turn is towards consultants, they're actually bringing in a voice which does not fundamentally agree with an egalitarian society based on a public education system. And besides, it doesn't save money. Tens of millions of dollars are spent in this country every year by governments on consultancy fees. If anything, it probably costs more than the money that was saved by cutting down on civil servants. The insertion of private sector methodology into the public sector has had a few good effects, you know, and there's no question about it. But largely the effects have been rather deforming, not because the private sector is bad. The private sector is a very important part of a successful democracy. But those methods brought into the public sector have a tendency to rather simplify the complexity of government. Why? Well, basically because they have two things driving them. One is profit, not a government purpose. And the second is, and this is not said enough, the necessity under tax systems around the world to inflate your costs in order to write them off against profits. Well, we all do that when we fill out our tax forms, right? Well, corporations do that. That's private sector accounting methodology. You build your costs up in order to reduce your taxes. Well, if you bring those two desires into running the public education system, you're way, way off track. And it starts turning into something which is usually called real cost accounting. And real cost accounting is one of the surest ways of making government services ineffective. Why? Because it has the necessity to measure everything. And by measuring things, it makes them more expensive. It actually makes it very difficult to make sense of volunteer activity by people who are employed. It measures time in a way which suggests that things are more expensive than they are. It often measures things twice because they have to be measured in every aspect. It's an inflationary approach towards accounting. You didn't think you were coming here to listen to this, but I really think it's a very important issue when you sort of look at how we decide what things cost. And you realize that the methodology that's used might be appropriate for a corner store or a medium-sized corporation, but it has nothing to do with the way the public sector is run. Doesn't mean the public sector shouldn't be careful with the people's money. It should be very careful, but it's about how it's done, with what basic understandings. I think that this sort of real cost accounting, seriously, in the public education field, discourages volunteer work, particularly by teachers. And it makes it very difficult to accept the value of non-measurable work. Take that and add to it another thing, which is a perfectly natural outcome of our success. And that is the rise, and many of you may have read what I've said about these things or heard me on them before, increased rise of specialization. We're all in favor of specialization. You know, someday I'm going to need that doctor who's going to be able to look at my left kidney or whatever if I have a left kidney. You know, we need the specialization, but we mustn't be victimized by it. And you can see the combination of the private sector methodology and the narrow silos of specialization implanting themselves on the way in which we think about how to run public education. And it's actually cornering us in a way, and cornering the kids. And I think both of these things are aspects of what would traditionally be called instrumental reason, but is really utilitarianism. And once you reduce your approach towards public education to utilitarianism, you're in deep trouble, because public education has some utilitarianism in it, but that is not the essence of education. And all of this, see, I told you freed me by saying, you said this morning, all of this has facilitated a kind of religion which I would call the religion of meritocracy. Everybody must be the best. We must have the best. We have the best marks. People at the top. Everything is about getting to the top. You know, there's an old joke that if you have a society based on winners, then basically 99% of society are losers because, you know, only one person gets to win, and you've all heard that. Meritocracy is more complex than that because it actually leads to mediocrity. What actually happens is when you start to design your education system to produce a society which is a meritocracy, which is essentially a non-democratic society, doesn't believe in egalitarianism, it's a Napoleonic theory, meritocracy. Once you start doing that, you're winnowing out people all the way along. So the brilliance of democracy is, you know, there are 31 or 2 or how many are there? A million Canadians now, 32, I think. And we, unlike a dictatorship, unlike a meritocracy, we have access to the intelligence of all 32 million, whatever that intelligence may be, however varied it may be. We have access to it all. But a meritocracy actually stratifies itself gradually and eliminates more and more the ability to go fishing, if you like, in the great pool of those tens of millions of people. At first it works for the first decade or so. And then gradually you find that you're really reliant on an increasingly reduced number of people. And then you turn around and you find that this elite is cut off from the vast bulk of the population and you're slipping into a situation of social mediocrity in the sense that society is run in a mediocre way and is unable to surprise itself, unable to find its true genius by going into that great pool of the full population for whatever its needs might be.